whoever you are out there, you know, pray that you be brought closer to your calling and then pursue that calling with reckless abandon. There's not enough time for us to get caught up in things that don't have generational impact.
Mm-hmm.
So find out your calling. When I'm done and I'm out of here and I'm hopefully very old and on my deathbed and I'm surrounded by people I love and people are whispering, asking like, man, like, what did he do? Like, while he was here, someone's going to say he created some things that changed things forever.
All right, people, we are back. Another episode of Business Untitled. I could not be more excited. I've got my man, Nate Parker. Let me tell you why I'm excited. I met Nate because he was a wrestler. Dave and I, we basically love wrestlers. If you're a wrestler, you're good with us. And so not only was he a wrestler, he was a wrestler who was giving back. He was an All-American. Dave and I were not All-Americans, unfortunately. Still pisses me off, actually. I still think about it every day. Nate was an All-American. He became an actor. He's done 45 movies, a director, lots of awards. And now he's got a business called Mansa, which we're going to hear a lot about. But I thought we'd kind of start this a little differently. Instead of kind of doing the linear, I was born in Virginia, son of a, you know, that we've always done. We like to focus on domain expertise here, right? We talk about how can you learn from somebody, right? So every time I meet someone, I figure, what are they great at and what can we learn? Nate has domain expertise around content, producing content, writing content, starring in it, and now basically in the content business. And so we're going to start this talking about content, and we're going to start talking about Business Untitled. So we're going to start with a little bit of a brainstorm here because we're 22 episodes in. We're doing okay, but we want to do better. And we're putting Nate on the spot to be our critic, give us some critique, give us some ideas. And so, hey, first of all, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome.
Welcome.
That was a long intro.
No, I love it. I love it. Amongst friends. I mean, I've known you guys for years and years, so it's great to come on and talk about business, talk about life, talk about all these things. So I'm really excited to be here. Awesome. And I've watched a lot of the show, so.
So we're going to go backwards. We're going to start with us because we love ourselves.
Well, yeah, what percentage of the show does Mike talk?
Well, I'll just say.
You have to give us the bad shit. Give it
nah,
to us.
No,
we want it.
No,
because you're the professional.
Yeah, you know, I think everything boils down to storytelling.
Just tear Mike to shreds.
No, Mike, he knows his stuff. I told him, I called him, I was like, yeah, I watched the show. The show is very interesting. I love the dynamic. I call you the referee.
You know what I mean?
You got Mike, you got Mel. And
what am I?
You represent the culture that cares. I mean, you look at the comments. It feels like they're
all say shout out to Mel, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Like, where's Mel at? Mel
shout out to Mel.
But I love the show. I love the dynamic. You got your older white dude that knows a whole lot of stuff. You got your younger brother that knows a lot but wants to know more. And then you have, you know, dad who keeps him on the rails.
I like
so
it.
It's good. It's good.
So what do you see in like other podcasts or, you know, like we're trying to reach an underserved audience, but not just an underserved audience, but that's our target, right? This podcast started because Mel was like, dudes, guys in my neighborhood never get kind of financial advice, never get to hang out with people with network. And so let's see if we can bring that through this podcast. What's the landscape out there? You know, what you gotta.
Well, the reality is everyone has a podcast, right? Like it's not 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to bring a conversation to an audience, one that lasts an hour and 20 minutes, you need to be saying things not that are just important, but things that your audience, the demographic you're targeting cares about. You know, so like when I was talking to Mike, I was like, who is your demographic? Like, who is this for? Is it for the older, I'm not going to say old anymore, but the more experienced and seasoned white dude? Or for the young people in the hood, like you're from Brooklyn, right?
Yeah.
Are your friends, are your boys, their families, are they watching the show?
Yeah.
The answer is no. You can't be afraid to ask them why not. I think the difficulty with when it comes to like taking a piece of content and bringing it to an audience or going to market is that you don't want the bad stuff. You only want to focus on the things that are working, kind of to pat yourself on the back, because it's also insecure for someone to tell you, no, your podcast is whack, it's trash. Like, you need to do it. So you have to ask them, do you care about what we're talking about? Are there dry moments where you feel like you want to skip or fast forward? Should we be talking about more current events? Mm-hmm. But I think it boils down to who is the audience? You know, like when I talk to my team, like, you know, when they bring stuff to me, I always ask the same question, not because it's a reflection of how I feel personally, but I always want them thinking about, like, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, we're building a sustainable garden in the hood. And like, that's great. But why do people from my block really care about that?
Mm-hmm.
What's going to make them say, you know what, that's interesting. I'm going to go and, you know, put some time into that garden rather than go to the, you know, I don't call them food swamps. Food deserts. I call them food swamps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because this food is just nothing you should be eating. But why would they rather go to the wing spot than go and eat some cucumbers?
Yeah.
So I think that you do sometimes have to make it cool, sexy, but at the same time, you have to ask people what they care about and deliver that to them.
Yeah.
You know, it's all storytelling. You said this in the last, you know, you were talking about Homo sapiens, and you're like, at the end of the day, we're telling a story.
Yeah.
So what is the story you're telling to your audience? But I'll go back, so I'll play the role, right? Like, who is your audience? Like, who do you want to be watching this? Like, even the people off camera, I see like a young, vibrant audience of just particularly young brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do y'all watch the show just because? I think that's a question you should ask.
Yeah.
You literally have your judge and juries right here.
Right.
And y'all can't front.
Because they won't be working.
That's the point. See, they can't be scared.
I'm joking.
So you got to pull them aside and say, you know, did you understand what we were talking about? Did you? And you do a good job of that. You'd be like, Mike, no, ETFs. Let's go back to that.
Mm-hmm.
So, number one, like, that's, who's the audience?
Yeah, that's really well said, and I think it's super interesting perspective to put on this. And, you know, I think Mel, want to defer to Mel, because really this, in a sense, was Mel's idea to come together, like the why of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, almost, you know, kind of meshed in with the audience is like, why are we doing this? And then effectively, like, where did we see that? So I'm going to turn it over to you to talk about that for a second.
I think it kind of started with, I know exactly where it started. It started with guys my age, guys younger, guys all from my neighborhood
mm-hmm.
that saw me hanging out with Mike, saw me hanging out with Dave, I'm sure Googled them, whatever, and was like, wow, these guys are wildly
very handsome.
Successful.
They're very handsome.
Very handsome. And there was like one in particular, just, you know, the one that they used to describe him, the one that says he's a billionaire all the time. I was like, oh, Mike.
Yeah, Mike.
So I would, you know, from time to time, I took them to the hood. We went to Trinidad. My friends would be so excited to meet them, hang out with them. They got him drunk, kidnapped him one night. But it was always the same thing. They were sitting there like, I want to know. I was like, I can't keep bringing, you know, not can't keep because they wouldn't be opposed to it, but how many people am I going to bring to Mike's house or Dave's house? Or how many times am I asked to, hey, can you have dinner? These guys are extremely busy. Mm-hmm. How many times I'm going to set up dinner? Mm-hmm. So it's like, how can we get this information out on a large mm-hmm. scale and have fun doing it?
Right.
And this is literally what we do every day, mm-hmm. as friends, as mm-hmm. best friends, as brothers.
Right.
I guess Mike is our dad, right?
Well, no.
In age-wise.
Age-wise.
In days, Uncle Mike. That's what we got to start calling him.
He's Uncle Mike.
And, you know, so it's like, and it wasn't for me mentally, it just wasn't hard. It was like, this is what we talk about all the time, mm-hmm. just naturally. So let's put a camera in front of us mm-hmm. and share the information. So it started off as, you know, just information for my community and my friends. And that started slowly and then fastly spreading. Mm-hmm. And then I was just saying this to Mike last night. I went to my friend Pickle's wedding. He's a Jewish kid, 700 people there. And so many people, Jewish people, were walking up to me that I never met before and was like, hey, you're the guy from the podcast. I love the podcast. So at this point, I'm seeing it spread past what was my expected target.
Mm-hmm.
And it's spreading. I go to Zero Bond and people are like, I love the podcast. I love it. When Miami, random people come up to us. So I mm-hmm. think it's just a business mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Younger, because younger people are trying to start businesses, and largely my community. But I'm seeing it firsthand spread to just everyone that's interested in business in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, like a younger demographic, though, right? Somebody that wants to be a little bit guided and maybe by our experiences.
Or even people that have businesses.
Yeah.
You know?
I think another interesting point on this, and we've talked about this, and I think it'd be interesting to do a live show to get connected to the audience, because it is a little bit hard to get connected and understand it. I'm not an expert in data analytics to understand exactly who and what is responding, and it's a really good point what you bring up, you know, trying to like ferret that out so that we can improve those spots. That
my big takeaway though is there are data analytics, and we haven't spent a lot of time using the data analytics to really understand it. Like, it was interesting. We had one clip that went pretty viral because we were talking about how well Indian Americans have done. Mm. And all of a sudden we've got a lot of Indian watchers. Yeah. A shout out to Indians. Mm. And so again, us, we need to take it a little more seriously to kind of figure out what that audience who's listening to us. We know what we care about. Mm-hmm. We're trying to give good advice and do it in a fun way to people that are aspirational.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And with a real eye on the underserved community. Mm-hmm. Because that's why we started.
I think data analytics, though, right? I mean, you could make them say a lot of things. They're certainly important, right? Mm-hmm. And at a big level, they're important. But for where we are now, I also think just connecting with a few hundred, a few thousand.
I'm in for the live.
You know, because it's going to just give you a feel of what that is. That data analytics run in one line, but you're going to feel some of that too. Like, what are people passionate? When do their eyes light up? If we're talking about X or Y, right?
So here's our big aspiration: in 3 years, we'll do a live in the Sphere. But right now, we're going to do a live in a bar.
No, we should do a live in Liberty Science Center.
I'm speaking it into existence right now. We're doing a live in about 6 weeks at, where's the place? Six to eight weeks
Liberty
the most.
Liberty Science Center. We should do it at Liberty Science Center. Shout out to Paul Hoffman, who's done an amazing job there. Built the biggest planetarium dome in the Western world. And it's where Lil Yachty launched his last album. Drake was there. It's a very cool venue, and it can seat, I don't know, 1,500 people. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I want to get back to Nate.
I think all that's great. I think it's a great start. And what's been helpful for me is getting it down on paper, because sometimes, especially for people like us, like mm-hmm. we move on passion, but we have to ask ourselves, like, what are the problems we're facing? You know what I mean? And what does success look like? If we know what success looks like, we can kind of back into the solution set, especially mm-hmm. something that can be sustainable. Because the problem is, and Mel and I come from similar backgrounds, is that, you know, we're not the rule. We're the exception to the rule, you know? And coming from a programming background, people do what they're programmed to do. Mm-hmm. So if you're asking yourself, why is it that these communities are underserved? If you're not asking yourself that question first, mm-hmm. then this is a waste of time anyway. Mm-hmm. But being able to ask yourself, like, why is it, one, why is the community that we come from the way it is? Mm-hmm. What are the systems that are in place that are doing their job? And how do we break down those systems? And how can this podcast be an advocate for that, mm-hmm. right? Because what you have is you don't have just two white dudes talking about, let's do some charity and just help some poor marginalized. You have someone that comes from that community. Mm-hmm. So the one is in some ways is on you to say, okay, this is what success looks like. And success looks like us producing 20 males. Mm-hmm. You know, male, female, mm-hmm. across this community. Success looks like us changing my neighborhood with something as simple as adding to the curriculum of the public school. And you're a billionaire.
Yeah.
You call and be like, can we add a class on financial literacy where they show the podcast? You know what?
Uncle Mike's blushing.
Right?
There's a billionaire too. He doesn't talk about it, right? Not like Mike. Oh, right. Ever, actually.
Right. Or also having someone, you know, in the same way that he's picked, you know, identified you, who are the two young ladies, young men that you can bring in here and sit in this chair and ask them what is important to them? Mm-hmm. You know, what are the things that they're facing? Because, you know, like, I'm a big, big believer in hip-hop, but mm-hmm. I also understand programming. And if there's nothing really counteracting the narratives of where people perceive us to be, then it's going to be very difficult for anyone to look like us to aspire past that. Mm-hmm. You know, we could talk about money all day long. Right? And then we can give people money and they can set it on fire in 5 minutes. And we know what that looks like. Right? But how do you get people to understand the value of the tool of money? I think that's the biggest difference of when I was coming up and what I was given. You know, like, you know, my cousins and we grew up, they put a basketball in the crib, an actual basketball in the crib.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what that is. You're an infant. You can mm-hmm. barely turn and look at it.
So they actually put a basketball in the crib.
In different crib. Why, though?
Oh, like, you mean your baby
like
crib.
Like a baby
crib. I thought you meant like
not
the
a house.
House.
Oh,
like,
no.
I was like, where's this going?
No. Not code switch.
No, right.
I'm not going to code switch.
Like, you're the one that's going to save us.
But look, that's what I mean. But what is the root of that? Like, is either escape, because, you know, I always say when I was coming up, it was a great escape syndrome. Like, everyone was like, the second you show promise, you're like, you can get out of here. Yeah. Like, you're in some apocalyptic escape from New York. You know what I mean? Like, you can get out of here. Because we know the statistics and we know what we're facing.
Yeah.
So if we're being programmed by these things every day, even by the people that are charged to take care of us, you know, in school or teachers or whatever, of course we're going to make bad decisions about money. We make bad decisions about a lot of things. So what does success look like for a podcast that has two billionaires, an aspiring billionaire, and it's looking like you're going to get there, right? Storytellers, right? A diverse workforce, because you got people that work here that don't all look like y'all. That's a big step. You know what I mean? What does the pipeline look like? And that's what distribution is. You're scaling the impact. You can go and say, come to dinner. They can see everything that they want, go home and be like, I just want to get rich. When money is like not even, the richer you get, you don't touch money.
Right.
You don't touch dollars. It becomes this mechanism for access.
Yeah.
Right? Energy. And that's what we don't have where we come from. No access. We're literally living in food swamps where there's a liquor store right there, and then there's like a mini mart with just cheap food, you got a dollar store that has no fruit, and then we're expecting these kids to pay attention in class.
Yeah.
We're expecting them to want to read the newspaper and save their money. It's not going to happen. Yeah. It's nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, so I think conversations like this, at being able to disseminate these conversations from a standpoint of scale, and then being able to have people that can hear, like an interpreter, what this means for us. Like I said, I learned from the last podcast when we were talking about ETFs. You know what I mean? You're talking about Bitcoin. Every time you talk, I'm learning something. But it's like, what do they say? There's learning, there's understanding, and then there's wisdom. You know what I mean? They say, Nipsey said, wisdom comes from experience. Experience comes from making mistakes. How do we erase the mistakes and get people from knowing something to be able to make good decisions without having to go to prison?
Right.
That happens here.
I tell you, just give Nate some props. Talk about learning. I have literally, I don't know when we started hanging out.
Years ago, 15 years.
Have learned more about the experience of being black in America from Nate. You might notice where Dave and I are white than anybody. And you know, shout out to Mel. I love Mel. I've learned a lot from Mel as well. But like, he made this movie, Birth of a Nation, which, now listen to this. This is a factual statement. When it premiered at Sundance, and it won all the awards at Sundance, he put the whole cast on stage and the producers. So I was on the stage. It got somewhere between a 25 and a 30-minute standing ovation.
Wow.
I've never seen anything like it in my entire life. A two-minute standing ovation feels like it goes on forever. A 20, 25-minute standing ovation, it was just the most obscene good energy you've ever seen. It was just this moment. And I remember the night before, he had the whole cast around. Everyone knew something special had happened. And he hopped up on a table and he was giving this props to all the people, right? Naomi King. Asia Naomi King, who was the female star and unbelievably, you know, cute and vibrant.
Talented, gee whiz.
We had a great cast and they're all there and Nate is, you know, the leader of this thing. And I noticed two things. A, he gave props to everybody, not to himself. He shouted me out, which I always appreciate being shouted out.
That's a billionaire Mike Knows conversation.
But I thought to myself, he should fucking be a governor or a president. And you've got that energy. And so, A, I appreciate you bringing it to us today here. I really thought that. I was like, here's a guy who thinks about things that are outside of himself. And thinks about systems. And so taking that now, you 40 movies, direct awards, and now you're doing business. So talk about Mansa for a second and why Mansa. Because it's interesting. We heard it from Kanye in a different way, right? We've heard it from a lot of people, right, that blacks have created culture and have never owned it, period. Right? Kanye was a little less gracious the way he said it, but he was his point was real.
Absolutely true, by the way.
Yeah. And so talk about Mansa a little bit.
Yeah. I'm going to go back, you know, for a moment. So when you were talking about, like, seeing people and recognizing people, so many of our people don't get seen, you know? You know, Ralph Ellison has this great quote that says, when a person goes too long without being seen, they'll soon lash out at the world to remind them that they exist. You know, so a lot of times we're seeing the manifestation of that invisibility, you know, play out in things that put people in prison or things that put people in very tough situations. So I've always believed that seeing people is really important. So like the fact that, I mean, going back to this podcast, like who are the people that need to be seen and encouraged to make take a step in a different direction? Because I don't think that you can move into your calling if you're not encouraged to do it. You know, like they some people are born hustlers. Like, no, everyone's motivated out of something that happens in their life. Mm-hmm. You know, and for us, it was escape. You know, it was, you know, literally get rich or die trying.
Yeah.
You know, it was this misguided approach to what are the things in the world that can get me to a place where I can, you know, really step into my calling. So yeah. Most people never get to it. For me, I always say everything I do is a reflection of what I want to see change in the world. If it wasn't telling stories, it would be something else. Like, I think people think that I, you know, love making movies. It's cool.
Yeah.
But what I really want to see, what success looks like for me, is that there isn't a need for this podcast one day.
Yeah.
Because financial illiteracy is something that is a constant across all demographics. You know what I mean? And that's going to take the type of work and undoing of things that, dare I say, is dangerous.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think that's some really profound stuff you're saying. I think what's interesting, having now done 20 of these, and what I've noticed also when we talk about some of the challenges coming out of the Black community, role models, right, basketball in the crib, right, because that narrative that's in the parents' home is this is the way that
the only
this is the only way,
this
right?
Is the lottery ticket.
And so shifting that, I think one thing I've noticed, and sometimes I talk to Mel about this, is, you know, it takes a long time to accumulate wealth. Mm-hmm. The news stories like to say, oh, it happened in 1 year, 2 year. That's like the lottery ticket version. But Mike and I have been at this for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a message. Like, if there's one piece of this message that I really like to get through to communities that are coming up, whether it's, you know, Black or, you know, of color or not for that matter, it's that, you know, you really got to just keep at it. And this idea of kind of quick money isn't really what happens. It's really like it's never linear. You're trying. And then all of a sudden, boom, one thing pops for you, you know? And you're kind of leveled up at that point in time. And you do it again. And I think there's an aspect, from my standpoint, being in development, where risk mitigation is a big part because it's a capital-intensive business. We're always borrowing money. I talk about that sometimes. Living to see the next day is a very big part of being successful.
Wait, literally and figuratively, because in our communities, living
to
see the next day. And I think that's something that people don't recognize. There's the, like, not to take away anything from the journey that has guided you both to being billionaires, right?
Yeah.
But the reality is that there are also factors. It's almost like if you and I are running a race and I have to run the race with a, you know, 200-pound bag on my back and with a cut Achilles and with a attack in my left heel and with a sniper on the roof and with a broken path in front of me and I haven't eaten in 5 days. Like, all of these things, and some people still do it. So I think that privilege is real. You know, access is real. Safety. Like, we take for granted safety. I was just talking to a friend about, I'm not even going to name the city because I don't want to, like, just kind of target a city with respect to trauma. But it's like, there are cities here where, you know, they do random checks of kids' backpacks and they have guns. And they talk to the kids, why do you have a gun? It's like, well, if everyone has a gun and I don't have a gun, like, bullies here do this. So I think that it goes back to what's systemic. Whatever sounds simple in and of itself is likely offensive. You know, to say all you got to do is get straight A's doesn't work.
Right.
Like, I worked at a school once where I had a kid who got straight A's, applied to USC, didn't get in. Why? Because the school didn't offer the AP classes. They didn't offer any of the things that would give him the competitive edge. So he had to go to junior college. End up being the steps that it takes. It's like 10 steps to one. Not to say it's impossible, just to say we have to recognize this. Like, one of the things my mentor used to always say to me, he was like, either something systemic has happened or we are just actually inferior. Like, super, so, you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And I think there's no doubt there are systemic, giant systemic things that are in play here. When I'm going to take your race analogy for a second, running race, right? And, you know, you've got a cut Achilles and a backpack and a this and a sniper, right? But... and that's true. And and the Black community starts out without a lot of advantages in terms of, like, embedded alumni in university systems or business leaders, right, that you know, they get into contact with.
Or even teachers that look like them.
Or teachers that look like them. So part of it is changing that system. I'd also say that having done these and knowing anybody that's made it may or may not have had an Achilles cut at some point in time or had to wear 20 pounds. Maybe it wasn't 50 pounds, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to also understand the assumption that there's a lot of people from a lot of different places, right, that don't even have to be of color from the hood, that face their own traumas at times, right? Mm-hmm. And it can be something that went down in that family. It can be about abuse. It can be about just a lot of things. And why I think it's important to say this is because at the end of the day, we want to change the systems and give as much equality on the input as possible. But to some degree, you're dealing with what you're dealing with if you want to be a success, and you need to find a way to push through that. And what I was kind of saying is, and that doesn't just happen overnight. Mm-hmm. That's a process. It's mm-hmm. a mindset. It's being all American as a wrestler, right? Mm-hmm. That's not one practice.
Do you think wrestling?
It's 1,000. Interruption jar, but fine, you're on.
It was interruption jar. All well, good. I was pivoting off the wrestling. Do you think wrestling?
And I was waiting for my turn, but go ahead.
Do you think wrestling and the discipline and the success was what gave you the ability to break out of, you know, Norfolk?
Yeah, I think so.
Hamptons, right? Hampton.
I'm from Norfolk, Virginia.
Norfolk, right.
Right. And there were a lot of factors. You know, I had a very strong group of, you know, aunts and uncles and elders. You know, family was super important to us. And I also feel like where I come from, when they see you have promise, you get protected a bit because they're like, he has something that we don't, you know. Let's pool our resources to whatever that means to give him this, him or her, what they need. They could be the one, you mm-hmm. know. And for me, thank God, it wasn't a basketball. I think wrestling was great for me because it was a sport that challenged me to overcome, you know, mental, spiritual, psychological issues every single day. You know, this is a great quote that says, discipline is giving up what you want now for what you want most. And it's something that it's hard to live by, but it's something I remind myself, like, okay, if I'm to be the one that will progress my family, you know, where I come from, is the name is big. Like, we are Woodberries, my mm-hmm. great-grandmother. And again, even when I say Woodberry, that name was given to us at some point, you know? Mm-hmm. It's only so far we can go. So when we talk about a race starting at a certain point, just identity, table stakes. You know, for a community, you don't know your great-great-great-great-grand. It is the line between who we are as Black Americans and even some immigrant groups that also are Black. And I'm a big advocate of, like, connecting the diaspora for that reason, right? Mm-hmm. Culture, identity, you have power in that. But wrestling, for me, was absolutely a tool that was helpful because it took everything that I learned about standing up as a man in the face of adversity and actualized it. It put it into something that if I only can overcome the person in front of me, I'll be one step closer to getting a scholarship. And then getting that scholarship, I'll be one step closer to putting my family in a better position. But along the way, there's no hiding. In wrestling, it's, you know, you stand in front of another person, and the person that is the most prepared will usually come out on top. And again, going back to safety, you know, it was a predominantly pink sport. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a bunch of people that looked like me, you mm-hmm. know? And so even the way I had to move in that circle to be able to survive, mm-hmm. you know, I went to a different school my senior year where I was one of very, very few. But from the second I realized, I'll tell a story about one of my uncles, whom I love. He said to me, you know, so I was playing football and I wasn't getting any bigger. And I was like 120 something pounds. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm like, I don't know if I should tell the story. I'm going to tell it anyway. He was like, yo, so you ever think about wrestling? I was like, wrestling? Because, you know, we come from wrestling. The singlets, they wear the bathing suit. Like, what is that?
Yeah.
And he was like, no, listen, you get on a mat with a white boy, and you just throw him down. Because uh-huh. you're weight.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, okay. He's like, and most of them are white boys. Mm-hmm. You know you're going to be able to, you know what I mean? It was this thing of like, taking on the man,
uh-huh.
you get what I'm saying? Yeah. It's like there's this kind of like feel like where we come from is the only people that look like us, and we know not necessarily who the enemy is, but we know who's not there. Yeah. We know what we don't have access to, so it's kind of like you can represent all of us, you know, day to day in a space with others that don't look like us, that from a symbolic standpoint or in some ways representative of the oppression that we're facing every single day. Yeah. So that there was that there were all these different things, hood wisdom. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I remember there was a big match at the Russell against a guy that was a state champion, and my uncle was pacing the mat in front of everyone with a gold chain in his hand. Mm-hmm. Real talk. This is you. This you. You win this you, nephew. Mm-hmm. He's swinging this chain. I still got the chain. I won the match.
Yeah.
But it was bringing a different, think about that. Yeah. It was bringing a different culture to a sport that did not at the time want our culture involved. Yeah. I remember that was on a particular team, and me and my only other black teammate, we weren't allowed to wear do-rags. And I remember being like, but they're wearing bandanas. Yeah. I was like, no, that's those do-rags. You know, that's thug. And it's changed a lot.
Yeah.
You know, you got your Jordan Burroughs, you got your Jaden Coxes, you got your all the, there's been this.
Put a do-rag on Monday. Mike last year.
You know who's the OG change in that? Really, Kenny Monday. Kenny Monday out of Tulsa had to deal with a lot of that. Yeah. When you hear Kenny's stories, right, because that was back in the 80s and you know,
Olympic champion,
shout out
to Morgan.
To Kenny Monday, national champ, Morgan State, Olympic champion, three-time Olympian. Mm-hmm. But Kenny, who's a good friend of ours, that was the Tulsa busing and all that crazy stuff was coming out of there. And
not to mention Wall Street, Black Wall Street, like the history of that
that's
city.
Right. Yeah. You know, and I think he had a big thing to do with really changing how the sport perceived, you know, African Americans, blacks in wrestling, because now it's a completely different game than when you were
there. At the DuPont estate, you know, Foxcatcher.
Well, he was a racist.
DuPont was crazy and racist, but he kicked all the blacks out, and USA Wrestling were like, if we don't want to lose this money, so sorry, blacks.
Literally,
that's a true story. Now, that wouldn't happen today. Half our great wrestlers are black at this point. Now we're starting more.
I want to say even like the Nationals last year, I want to say half of all that the wrestlers in the semis were like African-American, you know. Yeah. And you look at some, and again, it's access, right? Like we saw it happen in tennis. We saw it happen in golf.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And like I said, shout out to Morgan State University, HBCU wrestling program that is growing and thriving. And I'm working very close with them. Thank you, Mike, for your help in that. I want to go back to you had something to say, too.
Yeah, I want to go back to what Dave was saying a bit. We had dinner last night.
Mm-hmm.
So what Dave was saying always sticks in my mind, right? Literally, like, every time I'm, like, feeling down, because now I feel down about a couple different things, right? I used to feel down about not having access. And I was saying this to Mike last night. I'm like, fuck, now I got all the access in the world to get into deals, to this, that, that. And I don't have the capital that I need, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Mike said that to me last night. He was like, you're not broke. You're still a millionaire, but you don't have the, you know, to if we're putting in $100 million in a deal, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes back to me thinking about what Dave said. And I always got to remind myself of that. It took a long time. At my age, Dave probably couldn't put $20 million into a deal and be like, you know, but now he could. So it's a good reminder to myself that I'm like, you know what? It takes a long time to get there. And these guys, Mike is, you know, 83 years old, right?
Yeah.
And a half.
But he looks 59.
And on the other spectrum of that, right, I spoke to, so it was good to hear Mike say that last night. He was just saying, like, look, don't, like, it's rough and you can't put in on everything, right? Be selective and you'll get there. And one thing it hit big, or maybe none will, but you're doing different things. And 2 years from now, you'll be able to put in, or you may not, but it was just good to hear that because you kind of freak yourself out and you're like, oh my God, because you're almost like, and my cousin, I give my cousin credit to this, shout out to Arnold. He was like, you're comparing yourself to Mike and Dave and all the billionaires you're around. I'm not really doing it, right? But in a weird way, subconsciously, I am. So I'm like, fuck, I should have, if I could get in on this, I'd have been, and I just don't have that type of capital, right? So it was good to hear Mike say, you're not broke, but in my mind, I'm like, fuck, I'm broke, I still got millions of dollars in assets, and I'm still got millions of dollars in watches and this, that. So it kind of like, it's like a refresher. And my cousin said to me, bro, you got to look at it this way. Where you come from, this is what brings it back to how hard it is where we come from with that 500-pound bag. My cousin's like, realistically, you are your worst financial day from our neighborhoods is someone's greatest dream. And that just kind of was like such a humbling statement and almost like resetted me, because it is true. I come from Trinidad, and after Trinidad was Flatbush, and you know, when I'm having a bad day, I'm still all right, right? Compared to somebody in Flatbush or Trinidad, things could be worse. But to go back to what you said, right? I also believe that everyone's struggle and pain is tailored to them. Mm-hmm. And everyone has to overcome their... I'll tell a funny story, and I don't give a fuck I'm telling it.
When it's a jar, right?
We got to build up some money for the jar, so we need to cuss. So everyone pain is what Dave is saying, right? Like, everyone, Dave has had his moments that we shared that he has to overcome. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter how much billions of dollars he has. Doesn't matter how much apartments. That pain you're dealing with yourself. You have your pain that you have to overcome, right? So I believe, Mike, I believe everyone's pain is tailored to them. And the one thing we can't do, we could empathize, sympathize with somebody, but you can't actually feel their pain.
Right.
But you feel your own pain, I feel mine. Mm-hmm. So when I met Mike, however long ago this was, he gave me this like crazy speech that made me feel so fucking good. He was like, man, you know, like, this was seven years ago. He's like, you know, I've been knocked down, and which he has been knocked down mm-hmm. several times, and he was knocked down last week, and I was laughing because I'm like, you're like the comeback king, like whatever it is, he was knocked down. Wait, he grind. Probably lost a couple more grains of hair, but he overcome it and got back. And I've watched both of them, and that's resilience. But I met him, and this story is so funny. And I have a sad story to tell about something else that they don't even know. I met him, and he was like, you know, I've been knocked down so many times. Like, a few years ago, like, I was broke, and I came back from being broke. And I was like, this guy was broke, like, Let me tell the story. Yeah. He legit said this. So for 4 years, I'm just like, Mike was broke, like, and he made it back and became a billionaire again. And one day I'm casually just sitting telling this story because I like to tell stories. I'm like, yeah, Mike was broke and got back. And that's when he said, well, you know, I wasn't broke. I had like $300 million. And I was like, what? But again, that goes, if I had $300 million, I would have been like, oh, I'm, but that's his pain, right? So you didn't say it.
Let me ask you that. Let me like go for this one. I think you said something else really important, right? Which you were telling a story, but I want to talk about also, whether it's Mike's story or my story to financial success, right? In a sense, you use a lot of other people's money. So Mike's story was, he comes out, he goes to Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs, the most capitalized place in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And so in that context, you're allowed to risk effectively other people's money, Goldman's and firms, to reward yourself, right? And that comes with a big responsibility. But when you really dive another layer under the surface and you talk not about basketball stars or hip-hop stars, because that's not using other people's money. In effect, that's your own talent, and you're just getting paid very highly. But in real estate, similarly, right, loans and partnerships are a very big part of this. And I think that there's something really important in this idea that, you know, even when you don't have capital, as like you're just starting out, there's an opportunity to get other people to invest in you. It doesn't have to be that you just put away 4 years of savings and now you're going to risk it all, right? You have to be fair about it. There's structures, there's experience that comes with that. And one of the things I think Mike and I feel very deeply when you're talking about financial success is like, I treat other people's money like almost better than my own, to be honest with you, because I'm so cognizant of how important it is with that reputation to pay that back. And so it's something that as you start that practice and that discipline, right, it opens up a dramatic ability to accumulate wealth by risking other people's money in a considered way and then going to town for that.
And this is the systems that Nate talks about. It is really difficult to find other people's money if you come from underserved communities.
Yeah.
Now, there are things out there, SBA loans, right? There are programs out there that you've got to look into and figure out how to get to. But like, just like there are food deserts, there are banking deserts in underserved communities. Mm-hmm. And so, like, this is the challenge of when I started, I took over the Bail Project, and I remember Googling, and I wanted some, you know, real black wealthy guys on my board because criminal justice is really a racial justice, or a good portion of criminal justice is racial justice. And I Googled black billionaires, and I saw Robert Smith and Bob Johnson at the time, and I'm trying to, David Seward maybe. And then it was Oprah, MJ, yeah. LeBron, and I was like, wow, there's got to be. And so I thought to myself, okay, blacks tend to millionaires. And what I realized was there is a dearth. It's growing quickly.
But it's also reflexive, right? If they believe it, the more you believe it, the more opportunity will be there, right?
Agreed.
Do you know what I'm saying? It's reflexive. It's like the system is one thing, but then changing the system as a young black person and asking that question, understanding that that is what you need to accumulate
even
wealth.
Even in the 7 years since then, you've seen a big change, right? You have seen things like Mansa, which we're going to get around to talking about. You've seen people say, how are we going to get access to capital markets? How are we going to get access? Yeah. It's still a grind. We're in early stages of it.
It is, but it's both places, right? Because you have to be able to be in Mel's position, Larry Morrow's position, Nate's, with Mensa and ask that question. I'm sure you have investors in Mensa, right?
100%.
There's an example. Let's talk about that. That's a good way to get into that.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Yeah. And I think that we have to remind ourselves that there's a difference between being the rule and being the exception to the rule. And I think sometimes as a successful person, you have this, you're almost encouraged by others, specifically people not in your community, to embrace this idea, if you did it, everyone can do it. And it's just not true. And this will lead right into Mansa. A lot of my everyday is around when I'm done and I'm out of here and I look around and I'm hopefully very old and on my deathbed and I'm surrounded by people I love, and people are whispering, asking, like, man, like what did he do, like, while he was here? Someone's going to say he broke down some of those systems or he created some things that changed things forever. And that might be this wild and outrageous thought or aspiration, but it's like, was Jackie Robinson has a quote that a life only matters and the impact it has on others. So it's like, what are we doing? You know, I can make a movie every 18 months, do extremely well, especially understanding now distribution, and then die. But all my family is now, all Ivy League. Now we're having Mel conversations and we're money conversations. But that is now my family's the exception to the rule. Like, how do we change things at scale? And I think the answer to that is dissemination of those solution sets. And there's no better, platform for that than storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I make movies, yes, but my co-founders, David Oyelowo, Chiki Okonkwo, Zach Tangeloff, we were sitting around, and at some point, the complaining becomes this kind of like cyclical, like circle pity party, where you're like, things are so bad, what are we gonna do? And we looked around and we start seeing the things that were happening. We start seeing like subscription fatigue and people complaining about, man, I got Peacock now, I got to do that, I got to pay this with Hulu. All of a sudden, and then twice a year, they're raising those prices. So it was like, there is no like democratized access to content that is diverse globally, specifically content that speaks to the culture. Because I'm going to go back to something you said. They may have, no disrespect, I'm going to say that to start, they may have all the hundreds of billions or whatever dollars, right? They don't have the culture, right? You're here for a reason.
Mike certainly doesn't.
Right. Mike tries. Mike thinks he
really
does.
Hard.
If you look at his closet, you'd be like, he has got the culture on lock. He got the bedazzled jackets.
They've been kind of beating him in
the
closet.
Oh, he's coming up?
Yeah.
He's coming up?
They've been beating all of us
in
the closet lately.
We need to do an MTV
clip. I don't know what's going on.
But I think
they've secretly got a stylist now.
artist.
Yeah, but I think understanding your value, what you do bring to the table, is super important. You're a billionaire in culture. You do. You know what I'm saying? Like, and just to finish, from a standpoint of your impact on music, from the standpoint your impact on your community when you go there, but your impact on financial growth. You know what I mean? You understand systems that people don't understand. So now what is your job? Yes, it's to accumulate more, but it's also to make sure that whoever the cousin is or the brothers, you're scaling that in a way that is it doesn't end with you. Because the problem is, if you're, you know, for a lot of the athletes or for all the artists, we heard the stories. You know, they rock it up, then rock it down. Why? Because there's nothing to sustain them there. You know?
One of the reasons that's why this podcast is so important mm-hmm. to not just me, but mm-hmm. to all of us, because what better way to get that? It's almost like a class, I feel like, we're giving, right?
That's
like,
right.
This is one of the ways, one of the many ways. Dave invests in a ton of things that mm-hmm. is taking a chance on people. Mike invests in a ton of things that's taking a chance on people, including me, mm-hmm. right? And I've had a chance to invest in people, taking a chance on people. So, but this is like, I would honestly say, if this goes the way we want it to go, this is the largest way and the most impactful way
yeah.
that I see us doing that.
But I think like the impact of this show 5 years from now, you know what I mean? Like, the greatest achievement you can have is someone come up to you and be like, yo, like, start, you know, I saw the podcast and, you know, I start watching it more. I learned about ETFs and Bitcoin or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I put some money together. I took a pot around the hood. We started a little, like, basically a money bag, and we invested together, and we were able to transfer in community because of that podcast. That's success, you know? And I always feel that way. Every film I do, like American Skin, you know, it's like if somewhere some police officer is about to shoot someone and doesn't because they remember that conversation.
Take a beat.
Take a beat, walk away, we save a life, right? We win. So what you're saying about the podcast, what we're talking about movies, like all of these stories that we interact with, I always say, like, all these stories are like a tree, right? If the tree falls in the wood and no one's around it.
Yeah. I'd be a CEO now, Manson.
Yeah, okay,
well, I want you to be a CEO. Yeah.
I'm being a storyteller, and I'm telling the story. All right. What's the way to interrupt?
Hold on. I want to hear about Manson. God damn it, I want to hear about Manson.
If a tree falls in the woods and no one's around, you know, does it make a sound? And I think at some point when you're making films, and those films impact only the people that see them, but there's no way for you to control other people seeing them, it kind of dies on that day. Mm-hmm. It's only alive to the last person remembers it.
Spinning aim to Mansa, if right? you'd let him.
Yeah, see? Yeah. No, but I get it. So, you know, so Mansa is an advertising-supported streaming platform for curated global black culture. So advertising-supported as opposed to subscription-supported. And just like a really quick like background on how that works. So rather than creating revenue from asking users to subscribe X amount a month, what we do is we have advertisers mm-hmm. advertise to our audience. So we give it to the audience for free, mm-hmm. right? And then we sell our inventory by way of pre-roll, mid-roll, post-roll to advertisers to advertise specifically to our audience.
Can you say that again? Pre-roll, post-roll?
Pre-roll is a commercial that comes in before a piece of content starts. A mid-roll is a commercial that plays in the middle of it, and a post-roll is something that once it's done, it rolls, right?
And which one is premium? Which one is the most expensive?
The most expensive is subscription video on demand.
No, out of those three commercials, if I wanted to have a pre-roll, post-roll, or what's that?
Mid-roll.
Which one would cost me more as a...
It actually depends on how many people on the platform, right?
Okay.
So as you scale up, you kind of get to negotiate higher... campaign sales to advertisers, mm-hmm. right? So, like, we had a big campaign with American Express, or, you know what I mean? Like, we're doing something right now with Paramount Plus because David Oyelowo, our co-founder, is on Bass Reeves. Mm-hmm. So we kind of cross-promote to bring more of their audience to us and more our audience.
So this is a freemium model.
It's a freemium model. Like Tubi, yeah. Pluto TV, right. Freevee.
Hulu? No. Whose subscription?
Your subscription has an ad tier.
Okay.
But again, they're coming out of the pocket, and that's the revenue.
Uh-huh.
You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I always say the future's free. Like, all the indications are true. I mean, we made this bet 2.5 years ago. I came to you. So I came to Mike, and I said, look, this is going to work. You know, if we're really looking to create sustainable models, like, this is one that, mm-hmm. like, really democratizes access. Because, again, when you talk about diverse content, you talk about the global diaspora, and you talk about how content is changing Brazil, how content is changing Nigeria, how these stories are our stories.
Right.
And when you talk about how, you know, we're no longer the minority, we're the global majority.
Right.
So what did that? What does that mean when it comes to reflecting our stories? Yeah. Like, until we take back the narrative of who we are and who we aspire to be as a people, mm-hmm. right? Until we're engaged in that exchange of information, ideas, and stories, then we're going to be playing the same tapes, you know, and seeing the same type of stories through the lens of people that don't look like us, only kind of like a shadow of who we are, mm-hmm. because it's the representation of how they like to see us. And that's what we see. So for us, it was like, how can we create, kind of decolonize access to the type of content that we believe where we can have stories, storytelling like mm-hmm. this podcast, and put it in front of people so it can, you know, change the way they see the world.
Yeah. Treat me like a child in this, but is this more of a platform or more like of a channel, like in terms of how you
look? It's both. Uh-huh. So the way it works is simple. So you have like, imagine if, are you familiar with Tubi?
Yeah.
A lot of people. So like Tubi is a content library, mm-hmm. right? So Monza is a content library. We have, what makes us different, we're format agnostic. So we are long form, short form, user generated content, mm-hmm. podcasts.
Because so combining YouTube with Tubi. With
exactly, like with that. Everything. Okay. So, because we recognize that behaviors are changing. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like the average, you know, young person watching a show, and I say from 18 to call it 25, watches 8 hours of screens a day. Four of those hours are on social media. Right? So they're watching snack pack short form. So we're like, if we want to be the future of streaming and we really want to give access to younger people and keep their attention, because mm-hmm. again, I believe we're in the attention wars. I don't think we're in the content wars. Mm-hmm. How do we get attention? How do we get eyeballs? And how do we keep people there? You know, we always say we want people to come, watch, stay, and then tell someone else. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's a platform where you have a content library that is format agnostic. We have a social layer where you can asynchronously watch things together, comment on things, so I can be watched. So let's say, and we're going to put this podcast on the platform, by the way. Like, it's going to mm-hmm. happen. We talked about it at dinner, talked about my team already. But on our platform, if you go to Monza and you're watching this episode, mm-hmm. right, there will be like a little menu on the side where you can push and like, heart, thumbs up, thumbs down, or you can comment. Like, I love what he said right there, right? So the people that follow you get an alert. Someone's like, Mel's, you know, watching whatever. Goes into it, he can see what you said, and he can comment on what you said. So we're trying to bring the experience that the new viewer is having, that behavior when it comes to going from long form to short form seamlessly, and put it on our platform. We also have human curators that literally scour all of social media, all of content globally, and bring in the best of TikTok, the best of Instagram, and we have like a linear stream, or like a channel, and you can just watch the best of TikTok swipe. So we're combining all the things that we believe make the experience great. And you ask, are we a channel? So we do also have a channel. It's called Monza Mix. And what that is, it's called a fast channel. So it's free ad-supported television. It's kind of like old school broadcast where, like, you know the Wildin' Out channel?
Yeah.
I know y'all, where it's 24 hours, series. That's a fast channel. It's like on your Samsungs or your... So we have Monza Mix. It's the mm-hmm. best of all the things on our platform. Mm-hmm. We syndicate that out to your Roku, to Amazon Freevee. So we have mm-hmm. a channel called Rain. So Monza Musa. Anyone familiar with Monza Musa?
I am.
Right? Mike, are
once,
you?
I was about to ask. Richest guy in the world.
Why
did I name it Monza, right? So usually I don't talk about it until someone asks.
Yeah.
I was just about to ask.
So often we're kind of confined to this scarcity mindset when it comes to, you know, who we are and what we're capable of. But the reality is Black culture creates all culture. Uh-huh. And it's been that way since the beginning, literally the beginning. We are original. You know, we're not something that came out. We were first, right? Just from a biological standpoint, where you may be. So Monza Musa was the, you know, controlled gold, you know, spices all across the Mediterranean, wealthiest man to ever exist. So I wanted to embrace like an abundance mindset, mm-hmm. you know, to have something that didn't rely on the scarcity of who we were, but really embrace the totality of who we've been since the beginning of time, and really represent that in a style of storytelling.
And he was Black.
Yeah, he was African.
Yeah, what country was that now?
Like Mali. The Malian Empire.
Mali, yeah.
And that's another thing. So I think that the diaspora is so much bigger than the 12% of the United States of America. You know, even though 12% of the United States of America, Black mm-hmm. Americans create culture for the world. You can go to Japan, you can go to China, you guys are welcome. Saudi Arabia, there's a massive hip-hop movement in the Middle East. So it's just taking all of those, that export that we're not, we have no, when you talk about like investment, investing in ourselves, creating a space and partnering with, you know, these wonderful partnerships we've had through Roku and TCL and, you know, Redbox, and advertisers and create an experience that is unlike any other and do it for free. Cool. So everyone everywhere can be able to watch it.
That's like when I was in Qatar with Mel recently, people kept coming up to him and saying, Idris Elba, Idris Elba. They thought,
The question is, did you respond?
That's because you lost that weight. You're looking good.
How did you respond? Did you like, how you doing?
I took pictures with them.
There you go. There you go.
But you know, and Larry Morrow was with us. Shout out for the 10th time to Larry Morrow. But people just, you know, he's got braids. He looks cool. And people were just like all over
Drake.
That. Remember that? Yeah.
That's funny.
Everybody wants to talk to him.
Thing. It's cool to be recognized everywhere as a purveyor of culture, but it's cooler to own that culture.
You know what I mean?
Like we're the literally the only people who like have our children educated by the people who oppressed us. You know what I mean? And not that those particular people, but then we wonder why the system is broken. You know what I mean? It's like there's so many things that need to be changed. They're only going to be changed through us looking at. You're doing the math?
Go ahead.
Oh, no. They're only going to be changed.
No, he's about to interrupt.
No, that's right. They're going to only be changed by us literally taking back our narrative and then disseminate to the world through our lens. And that's what Mansa does. Like, at its core, it is saying that this is who we are. These are our stories. This is the breadth of who we are. Because I think that when it's a narrow perspective, then you go to the Middle East and they're like, braids, Drake.
Yeah.
Like, no one's looking at Mel and being like, Robert Smith, you come here all the time.
Right.
You know, how do we scale Mel?
Yeah.
How do we scale David Stewart? How do we scale them? And I think the only way to do it is to tell their stories. In the same way we have a podcast that's about business and finance, you know, Melody Hobson, who is one of the most extraordinary people on earth, imagine following her around for the day. You know, when you talk about power, the power of black women, the power of being able to move in these rooms and to mentor people who are iconic. She's doing it. There are more people than the entertainers, you know?
Only thing I would, I don't want to use the word challenge, but the only thing I would say is that we can be thought by, it's never going to be by the people that oppress us, but I guess it would be their ancestors you're talking about, right? So like white, Jewish, Jews didn't oppress us, but whites did. And we can be thought by them because from my personal experience, there's good people everywhere that understand so much. There's people who have ancestors that has oppressed someone that kind of like really took a second and dived into it and understand how much these people in our communities need help. And you know, shit, actually, his daughter is one of them, Anna. She is a social worker, does not have to be clearly because her dad's a billionaire. Mm. And she has been dedicated, since I met her, she has been dedicating her time and her life to going into these underserved communities and putting on this hat and teaching these kids out of sheer passion of wanting them to do better for no financial gain, realistically, because it's what she loves. So that's the only thing I would say about that.
This is what I say. If the shoe fits, wear it, right? Like, if I'm not talking to you, I'm not talking to you.
I just wanted our viewers to understand that part.
100%. Yeah. I want the viewers to know, too. I'll say it again. We have to make sure that we're discerning the rule from the exception to the rule. Like, I'm an exception to the rule. I can, I could just say, I tell our stories. Like, look what all that I'm doing for us.
Yeah.
Look at everything. I never took the other mind. I always do stories. The reality is I'm the exception to the rule. I had access to things. I had access to Mike. Mike invested in Birdman Nation. Sure
look
did.
Look at me smiling.
You know
smiling,
what I'm saying?
Smiling.
He was American
skin. What he's saying is true, that there are systems in place that make it really hard.
And that's
the point. And it doesn't mean they're not good people. It doesn't mean they're not kids like my daughter Anna, who's out there working the world. It's still makes it hard.
I agree with that, but I just wanted to make it very simple.
Here's a point I want to make about how sometimes we forget where we started from. When Nate got that standing ovation in Sundance, and I was sitting there as like a proud uncle, why Birth of a Nation was such an important movie was, in a lot of ways, it was the first time a black guy produced, wrote, directed a black movie with a black hero.
Mm-hmm. Like Nat Turner, the Nat Turner Thank Slave Rebellion. Mm-hmm. Nat Turner was a hero for the black community. And I remember sitting there. Spike Lee was a few seats away. I mean, there was it was mostly a black audience in the front four rows, plus yours truly. and there was a palpable tears in people's eyes. They were like, finally, we have someone telling our story. And the protagonist is a hero, mm-hmm. right? I mean, if you watch this movie. That was only 10 years ago. Like, and that was the first.
That was the birth of Wakanda.
Yeah, and it was Braveheart more than it was anything else.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I mean? It's like this.
And so we're making progress, but like it's shocking. I was like, that was the first time, and then we were like, well, but yeah, that Tarantino movie was kind of a caricature of that, right? Django. There wasn't, you know, you start searching back, and it's not that there weren't great black actors and great black actresses and black movies told, but. By a black director, a black writer, black producer, and having the main character being a star. And so that was shocking to me.
And it's amazing to come through that and that you, humble that you describe yourself as an exception to the rule, of course. We're all exceptions to the rule to some degree, right? I mean, this country, the promise at the end of the day of liberty is that you have the ability to be the exception to the rule. If you really break down the fundamental premise, the idea of America, right, is that anybody has the shot to work hard. And I agree, there's systems.
Look, do you believe that?
I do believe that relative. Listen, it's an imperfect world. Mm-hmm. But I think if you're looking at the political systems and countries that were founded on an ideal, right, doesn't mean the ideal is always practiced. It doesn't mean there's a lot. And slavery is the original sin in that as well, mm-hmm. okay? But I'm saying, like, I do believe it because there's still time and time again where you see people that work hard, that come here with nothing, you know, that succeed. And that just doesn't exist in places like Europe. That really doesn't exist. Many
but,
places.
But we've gone, our social mobility index has gone from, like, when we grew up in the 70s and 80s, the idea of social mobility was here, and now it's here. And the practice of social mobility has also gone down.
And
we have
what?
Less people jumping from the working class to
but
the middle class.
If, in
but we're
sense,
still better than most places.
Well, no, but I'm not even going to say that. That what's really going on is that that problem is spreading to a lot of other communities. It's really what, you know, goes beyond this populist movement we're seeing here today,
right.
in a sense.
The problem,
so
the problem in the
broad,
black urban areas is broadening out.
It's a broad problem right now. I'm simply saying, you know, you said one, Mike said something to me once also, which I thought was really interesting. It had to do with somebody, I don't even remember who had like kind of like fucked him over with something. I don't remember even who it was or what it was. And my mindset, you know, I was like, why do you let that guy still like show up to your brunch or whatever it is or come in, you know? And he was like, you know, I just don't get hung up on negative energy. I feel like where I want to be is positive energy and moving into the future. And I thought that was a really interesting point, actually, because, you know, even myself, I can sometimes get hung up on that and be like, oh, all right, well, this happened, so... And part of that's like survival and realism, but part of it's also like, you know, just your mentality, right? Your mindset is pretty optimistic and you don't want to be caught in negative energy. Mm-hmm. You can talk about that if you want.
Well, but it's also, I think often, I was talking with my trainer today about an ex-friend who really kind of rogue on me for about 2 months and then was back to being a good friend. And he was like, and my family was upset at him and I just let it go, and I was like, that was his issue, not my issue.
Right.
Most of the time, people are doing something really stupid. It's even too stupid to you, it's their issue.
That's right. Mm.
It's their trauma. It's their stress. It's their background. Mm. It's their, you know, even like the criminal justice. Why do I do the work in the criminal justice space? Is most of the guys I meet are guilty of being born in the wrong zip code. Mm-hmm. And that neighborhood and that environment, you know, got them into a position where survival or what their buddies did or because they were in a, you know, a young gang because everyone was in a young gang did really stupid things. And so I was like, I'm going to hold that against them or I'm going to like try to understand where it came from. Mm-hmm. And it's not impacting me. And quite frankly, separating yourself from the other is an amazing technique of staying happier.
Yeah.
Like, why hold a grudge on somebody?
No, but you have that too, Dave. You guys, and I think the reason why we all connected the way we did and, you know, it's like this brotherhood that's unbreakable is because forget how you guys treat me. Mike always say, when I would tell him, this one's, he's like, super nice to me. I'm like, that's because of who you are. But the things I see with them, and I'm sure you've seen it too, Mike and Dave literally pass judgment on no one. Mm-hmm. No matter what they have done in the past, no matter, unless it's like some kind of fucking insane weird shit that's like, I just, you know, but for the most part, like, Mike invited one of my friends and his entire blood gang here to shoot a podcast, right? And so much people he hired that he gives a second chance to, you know what I'm saying? Dave, same thing. Dave literally do not even want to hear about that shit. Like, I don't care what this person's done in the past. To some, you know, there's some exceptions. I want to know who this person is now. Bring him. Let me talk to him. Let me hang with him. So, and that's not something they got from me. I met them that way, and it was something that I just kind of sat back and noticed, and I was like, wow, I've never really seen this before. This is so cool. Like, I had a situation where somebody called Mike and told him a ton of different things about me, and literally it was just I'm old enough to pick my friends. Mm-hmm. Phone hung up. Mm-hmm. It could have been a different person, and that would have been like, oh my God, wait, did it? Because the person calling them was a person, a very powerful person, right? Mm-hmm. But being who he is, being who Dave is, I've seen him, and that's not just with me. I've just observed that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes them really special.
All right, thank you, Mel.
this all right, fucking guy.
I appreciate it. I'm also cognizant of time. We got Nate. We don't have him forever. We got and like. You know.
Everyone's enjoying this conversation.
No, I know, but this other dude is like, you know, no,
I think it's all relevant.
You got to leave?
No.
You sure? Because we could replace you.
No, I think it's all relevant.
Eugene's at the door, right?
Because but it goes back also to like diversity and storytelling. Like, what are we telling stories about? We don't always tell stories about healing. We don't always tell stories about redemption. We don't always tell stories about friendships. I always say we're more than that, or we're that and. Mm-hmm. You know, we're more than basketball. We're more than rap. You know, we have conflicts and we have conflict resolution. You know what I mean? And we do it at the highest level and we do it at the street level. All of these things make up who we are. And for me is to really capture the tapestry of who we've been from the beginning to where we are now. Because I think that that's the thing that we always forget. And you bring it up and you're like, the founding of this country. We often have such a short-term memory on the why we are who we are, mm-hmm. not recognizing that in the span of humanity, like these things are just blips. You know, we're a mist, we're a vapor. We're here and then we're gone. Yeah. So what are we going to do with that vapor? How are we going to say that? And that mist that of existence that we had, we actually changed some things. We healed some people. We had some conversations. We had good food. We gave good food to others. You know what I mean? Like, what? Again, life only matters in that short period of time and the impact it has on others. So what's the impact? Yeah. What are we doing? Because, you know, again, we can, you know, we accumulate a lot of stuff because that's the biggest difference, right, from where we are now. I mean, you look like even the civil rights movement. Like, the difference is there are a lot more options. There's a lot more stuff, and you don't know who the enemy is anymore. Like, it's just like everything's it doesn't change the fact that these things still exist. Mm-hmm. It just changes the way our perspective of it because we're in the forest thinking that right now is time, and it's not. It's going in an instant. Mm-hmm. So how do we spend that time? Because what they say, you can't put a hearse on you can't put a U-Haul truck on a hearse. You know what I mean?
That's true.
And you talked on the last podcast about the big transfer of wealth that's coming up. Yeah. Like, it's upon us. It's happening.
It's happening.
All this stuff we're accumulating, like, this is, like, biblical. Like, the moth's going to be eating it up. Other people are going to be spending your money in ways that you never would have spent your money. That's the game.
Yeah.
So those things.
Someone's
going
to be living in your house.
Living in your house. In your bed. Doing all the things that you didn't, you know, that you wouldn't have done. But, again, if that is true, then what does success look like when it comes to our life lived? What is our legacy? What, you know, what if like I always say this, if my neighborhood where I came from, or my community looks exactly the same as it does from when I lived there to when mm-hmm. I died, I have failed all those people, right? Like, if my community is the exact same it was when I leave, and I think filmmaking and storytelling, it's like it allows us to scale ideas very quickly and to do it in a way that captivates people for a period of time and then has them leave talking about it in a way that's hopefully productive.
Really cool that you were able to align your passion with this platform, mm-hmm. take storytelling, which you're so great at,
thank you,
and content creation, and have a dream of how to distribute this and change lives. I mean, that's really where it's coming together right
now.
And that's really cool. That there's that intersection of what we're trying to do with this, what you're trying to do.
Were you a storyteller when you were like
12?
No, I just wanted to be rich. Real talk. Where I come from, it's like, what are you going to do when you get older? I'm going to be rich. I'm going to figure this out because I know what poverty feels like. I know roaches and, you know what I mean, perforated steel stairs, projects. Like, I'm not. So, but I think that is also a part of the problem. So
I remember the narrative of, I was like, how did you become an actor? He's like, well, I had a girlfriend. She was going to apply for a part, and I showed up there, and some lady came up and said, hey, what about you?
Yeah, that's right.
She got all pissed at you, and so you didn't even think about being an actor.
No, I never would. I just didn't see. I can remember meeting with my my advisor when I first got to school. So I got a full scholarship to school. I get to school, and I have my advisor. She's sitting in front of me. And she was like, "All right, you know, what do you? Let's figure out these classes." And she was like, "You know, so what do you want to do? What are you passionate about?" I said, "You know, I'm passionate about whatever it is that you know will make me a lot of money." And she was like, "Well, you know, you can't think of it that way. You know, you're an athlete. You want to start with some leg." I said, "Listen, man, like where I come from, I'm the only one here. You know what I mean? Like none of my family have been in this position. How do I come out of here with some way to make money?" And so. Mm-hmm. I got into, you know, like a computer science based, like management science information systems. And it was hard. It was very difficult to be in that type of field and to have to be a Division I athlete. But for me, success looked like making money so I could pull everyone from my family out of the situation they were in. And it wasn't until I started like learning about the Nat Turners. And it's funny, I didn't really learn about him until I left my hometown. But he was from my hometown because in our education system, they don't teach those things. And I started saying, well, wait a minute. There's something here. And then when I became an actor, and I went to Hollywood randomly because, I was interviewing for jobs. And so a girl I was dating, she went to this modeling thing, and I just showed up with her. And the guy was like, you should read this monologue. I read the monologue, and he's like, you need to move to L.A., like, immediately. And his answer was like, because if you remember, Antoine Fisher just came out a long time ago, and he was like, there's a shift in Hollywood. They're starting to hire black people. And and I came, and then, like, the first couple jobs was like, or the auditions were like, pimp number one, smack someone, shoot at the next person, and smoke a joint. It was just like, what are we doing? And I thought, I'm going to start writing. So that's when I started writing. So, you know, I never went to film school. I just thought to myself, I know the type of roles I want, and I don't see them, so I'm just going to start trying to figure them out. Cool. And then I became a writer. And then, but I would say that the biggest leap that I've taken, the one that I'm most proud of, is distribution. Because then everyone that is a storyteller, you're creating a platform for them to have an entry point to telling that story and disseminating that story to the world. Because like you said, your story is different. All of our stories are different. All of our pains are different. If that's true, then why aren't we seeing the diversity of those experiences? Well, the reality is we don't own the pipes. It's like anything else. I always give this analogy. It's like, you know, if someone said to you, like, yo, you like, I want to build a house. Like, great. You know what? We're going to give you the house that you want. Like, what do you want? You're like, I want 20 rooms. Okay, great. You know, where you want it? You perfect location, on the water. Fantastic. All those things, right? Like, all right, what else do you want? Gold-plated, everything. Fantastic, right? So your house gets done. You bring your whole family because it's like 20 rooms. Everyone can fit. Everyone shows up. They walk in, people running through, claiming rooms, all that. And all of a sudden, someone comes back and they say to you, like, Mel, like, is this a joke? You're like, what are you talking about? This is a beautiful house. Like, it's a great house. And they say, well, where's the bathrooms? You look around, you walk around, there's bathrooms, no bathrooms. Someone else comes back, like, where's the kitchen? You walk around, there's no kitchen. All these rooms, beautiful home, but you have no plumbing.
Yeah.
There are no pipes.
It sounds like when I met with Kanye and he wanted to do a development and he had no bathrooms in there. Remember that? We got a big argument about it. I'm like, well, where's the bathroom?
Mm-hmm. But what was his answer to that?
He said, What do I care about bathrooms? I'm Michelangelo. I'm Picasso. That's like for someone else to figure out. Like, I'm designing a dream. You know, a little bit like that.
Yeah. Well, I say it. The point is, you can have everything and have nothing. You know, you can have all the money and all whatever, but no pipes by which to disseminate your ideas from young people to old. It's like wisdom.
I love that. Young people old.
Right? Did I do that? Did I point that way? I'm so sorry. Look.
I got the gold coin here.
He said I got the... But yeah.
I might just keep it at this point.
But again, I always say, like if you don't have any pipes, they say content is king. I don't believe that. Because I've seen people make extraordinary content, and then for whatever reason, it doesn't get accepted into whatever festival, and now it's sitting on a shelf, and now it's old, and now it's lost value. Yeah. Right? Distribution is king and kingmaker.
Yeah. Fun question, real quick.
Go. Nate. Fun question. Go.
When did you make your first $1 million? What age?
Jeez. 7 years ago.
How old are you?
I'm 44.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good age.
Mm-hmm.
What was your biggest purchase?
My biggest purchase? My home.
Love
I
that.
I love my home.
I got a fun question for him. You made 45 movies. Give us the three ones you look back and you're like, that whole experience was just, forgetting Birth of a Nation, other, mm-hmm. like, you know, got Secret Life of Bees, you got all kinds of things you were in, Stars, like the experience. What movies you look back and you're like, God, I'm so happy I was in that movie. Great Debaters.
Well, I did a film that no one saw called Tunnel Rats, and it was about the Marines that were go through the tunnels of Kuchi or whatever in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And I got to shoot that in Africa. I said yes to that. It was shot in South Africa. I got to visit KwaZulu-Natal, where the Zulus were, Johannesburg. It was one of the greatest experiences of my life. I'd never gone before. I took the job without seeing a script, because there was no script.
Mm-hmm.
And the director, there weren't a lot of fans of his work. But the second they said Africa, I'm like, cool. Because how else would I, at 24, be able to go on someone else's dime, but and experience the entire culture or the culture of that region? And it was breathtaking. It was one of the great experiences. And I've gone back several times since then. I've took my mother and my uncle back. And I've spent time in Nigeria. That job to me was, and I got the call while I was on that job. It was right before I did Great Debaters. And I remember I said no to everything, so I wouldn't audition for anything, because I felt like if it wasn't alignment with what I thought my calling was, and it drove my agents crazy. They were like, "This is not how this works, man. Mm-hmm. Like, you gotta take some stuff, one for the real, one for the meal." I was like, that's not what I want to do. I want my grandmother to be proud when she sees something. So I had this opportunity to audition for. So when the Great Debaters came up, everyone wanted to audition for it, as you can imagine. Like, it's Denzel Washington, it's Oprah Winfrey, it's Forrest Whitaker, it's like Kimberly Elise. Like, everyone's in it. Was Kimberly Elise in it? Or am I blanking now? I haven't just had a senior moment. She was in Pride.
Uncle Mike moment?
I had an Uncle Mike moment. Why do I keep looking left when I say old things? No, but seriously. So
I'm loving this so
I get,
much.
So I auditioned for, so I go on tape, and the whole time I had the script for like a year before, and I decided I was going to learn the entire script, line by line, everyone's role, even my own, just to, so when I stood in front of Denzel, I could be like, there is no other person, you know? So, and this is before I knew I was going to get the audition. My agent was like, you're probably not going to get it. He wants to hire this other guy. And so, and I say this because it leads into the second job, the second experience. And so I remember the day, so I do the audition, I go to Africa, I'm in Africa, I'm like touring, eating the best, it was just the best experience of my life. And I get a call, and it was, I want to say Denise Chamian, who's the casting person. She said, Mr. Washington wants to meet you. So I'm like, dope. So I come back, when I get back, and I go and I audition for him. And I wrote a 100-page biography. I talk about this in other things, but, and it's like this thick thing I wrote by hand. Mm-hmm. I knew the whole script by heart. And I walk into the room, we do the audition. He keeps trying to trip me up. Go to the scene, go to the scene. I knew it all. I didn't even look at the paper. I never broke eye. I just was like, it was like a wrestling match.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I came in and I was just ready to go. I was like, I dare you say anything and think I don't know it. And then I got that job. The single greatest experience of my acting career, because I got to, you know, one of the things I wanted to do, I asked him, I said, can I, on the days that I don't work, can I stand behind your directing chair? Because I want to be a director. He said, absolutely. So the first few days I'd be, you know, sitting behind him and he wouldn't say anything. He'd do his thing. And I came like dressed to the nines as a character, like just quiet. And after about a week, he leaned back and says, well, the reason I did this is this and that. And I always thought that was cool, because now I'm the actor being mentored as a director by the director, who is Denzel Washington. And it was just an extraordinary experience. I'd say the next one would be American Skin. And I think because it was made out of the kind of the rawness and tumult of George Floyd. And the crazy thing is it was actually Tamir Rice, because it was before George Floyd, but it was that season,
right,
where it was just constant. And I, you know, I adopted my nephew at 13. My sister had other kids, and he was just a boy being a boy, and he needed a man in his life. And his father had been in prison, so he came to live with us. And Michael Brown happened, and he was like Uncle Nate, like, and he goes to a very affluent school, you know what I mean? Very nice neighborhood, and he is beautiful, dark skin, braids, whatever. And he was scared. He said, what do I do if I get pulled over police? I was like, well, wherever you are, just stop and call me. And I was like, no, don't call me. Don't grab your phone. I was like, okay, just really slow. And I realized I was traumatizing him with this instruction on how to survive. I was like, I don't have the answers. I'm going to get your answer. I went, Michael Brown came back, and then, you know, I started writing the story. Wrote the story, made it for, like, $500,000, and, you know, did a bunch of research. And it was kind of like a love letter to my nephew, just to say, I love you so much. I'm going to give you answers to this. It was a very emotional experience. So those are the three things if I have to – and, again, it goes back to things that I – that projects that I thought were impactful to others. But again, when you think of like Lena Waithe, you think of like Ryan Coogler, when you think about Issa Rae, like all of them came up as independents, and it was by a miracle, a divine appointment, they were able to break through. But I just believe that there are thousands of them out there all over the world just waiting for someone to believe in them enough to platform their talent. And that's what Monza is. Cool. You know?
All right.
Give it to me.
We got at the end of our podcast. Mm-hmm. We give everyone an ounce of gold. Dave used to actually pay for all the gold. And finally, we got a sponsor. We've got JM Bullion. They are the biggest, you know, direct-to-consumer gold seller in America, right? They're a subsidiary of A Precious Metals, which is a Fortune 500 company. They are kind enough to give us an ounce of gold for every episode. Our first and only sponsor. We love them. So shout out to them.
Shout out to
shout
them.
Shout out to them.
You talk about a differentiator. Yeah.
I mean, we had no sponsor. And, they showed up.
This is
and
let me tell you a little bit of macro here. Gold today is trading the highest price it ever has in its history.
Oh wow.
My predictions since we started, it's going to 3,000. I still believe it's going to 3,000, so I would not sell that at least for a year.
Yeah. I'm not going to sell it.
And with that, we ask for, like, your little ounce of gold, your kind of touch of wisdom that you want to leave our viewers with.
Leave the entrepreneurs with
we end this podcast with an ounce of gold.
Ounce of gold.
You've said a lot of great ones, but what's your last ounce?
I would say, let me think. Y'all really gave some gold away. Like, that's crazy. I'm still, like, wrapping my head around this. Like, you really want to have impact? Invite someone from the hood, sit them here, ask about the experience, and give them some gold. Like, that's real. I would say, find, you know, so I lead with my faith. You know this. You know what I mean? I don't tell people what to believe, but, you know, I'm a Christian. I believe, you know, I have my beliefs. They're very, very, very much ingrained in who I am. I only say that to say, whoever you are out there, you know, pray that you be brought closer to your calling and then pursue that calling with reckless abandon. There's not enough time for us to get caught up in things that don't have generational impact.
Mm-hmm.
So find out your calling. Like, even for a high school kid, if you're thinking about what you want to do, it's easy to say, I want to make money. We all want to make money. But what's your calling? What do you believe the unique calling on your life is that only you can do?
Mm-hmm.
And then think about how you know, pursue that with reckless abandon. When I realized for me it was storytelling, I threw my whole world at it. And you know that. It's what I eat and I breathe. And I see with you in music and in finance. I see with you in finance and in future-facing, you know, technology around money. And so it's like, find out your calling, you know. Mm-hmm. And then once you get and you figure that calling out, because that's your compass. That's your GPS. That's putting in the address. Then no matter the turns you take on the GPS that are wrong, it'll always course correct you back to whatever that calling is.
You know, when I'll last end with one story about that, because when Nate came to me and said, hey, I want you to invest in Birth of a Nation, I even read the script. And I didn't read the script because I'm not a detailed guy. I didn't read the script because he had such passion. And he was like, dude, I am not going to not win on this thing. You just have to trust me. And we had like 14 Jack Daniels, and at the 15th one, I was like, dude, I'm in. But again, when you have that calling and you've done your work, it resonates.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was an easy sale.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If he came mealy mouthed and saying, I'm trying to make this movie and I don't know, there's a lot of risk to it, I'd have been like, not for me.
Great ounce of gold. Find your calling, reckless abandon.
Reckless for it.
Nate, thank you so much, buddy.
I loved it, man.
Yeah, my
great.
Man.
Thank you.
It was amazing.
Amazing.
All right, be well.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Oh, lots of fun.